funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I once read that students come to love the subjects taught by their favorite teachers, rather than the other way around. A teacher who is passionate and curious, patient and creative, holds the power to hook students on just about anything and make learning feel more like an adventure than a chore. Even beyond their own areas of expertise, great educators help students develop the skills to explore and communicate ideas across a range of disciplines. So what makes a teacher great? My two guests have given this a great deal of thought over the course of their careers. Brett Iverson is professor of chemistry at UT Austin and outgoing president of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers. John Seibert is associate professor of chemistry at UT Dallas and president of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers in the University of Texas System, which has just published a book called The Little Orange Book, Short Lessons in Excellent Teaching. They join us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, the really remarkable thing is that conventional wisdom has it that professors who have any kind of research interest want nothing less than to teach, particularly undergraduate students. How is it that teaching became a priority for both of you?
I couldn't imagine being a professor without focusing on what goes on in the classroom. It's really the most exciting part of my day, and it's the part that really lives on. Because whatever we do in the lab, it might be a really interesting experiment, but it's probably going to only be interesting for a few years. But if you can inspire a student, that inspiration can last a lifetime. And that's something that just absolutely never gets old.
A teacher's legacy is the number of people with whom they come in contact. And so I think that embracing that role really defines a professor. Professors should have as their job description, run towards students, not away from them. It's also worth recognizing that both of us are at research institutions. So your initial comment, a perception that many people have, that a university, a research institution, is focused heavily on research, is actually really more of a perception than reality. There's a tremendous amount of interest and focus among all of the faculty on the student experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not only that, I always feel compelled to say at this point that the distinction between teaching and research isn't actually a clear one anyway, that line is very blurred at just about every level. And so I think it's a bit of a false difference. And so when you think about what you've learned in your research world, that comes right into the classroom and the other way around. Quite often, a student will ask me a question I've never thought of before, and that'll catalyze some thinking in my mind that ends up showing up in my group meeting in my laboratory. And so there really isn't this sharp line at major research universities that some people might have thought that there were.
Do you connect in a different way with students who plan to enter STEM professions than those who might simply be taking one chemistry class to satisfy a science requirement?
Brett and I were talking about this a few minutes ago before we started the program at a coffee shop. And the idea that students come to the university understanding what they want to be is really false. And there's opportunities that faculty members have within their classrooms, outside of the classroom, to expose students to new aspects for potential careers just for their own benefit based on the courses that they teach and the fields that they're in. In fact, a professor is really an ambassador for their field. In STEM, it's really important. Because people, not just students, people in general are curious. And you can tap into that curiosity gene if you present your material in an engaged, very passionate way and draw people in, whether they become majors or not. And then my contention is, I think the general contention is, that the students will spend more time on the details, the testable details, if they're first drawn and interested in the material. So from a STEM perspective, those introductory courses that students take in the freshman year are extremely important from the engagement side. Oftentimes there's a focus on grades, but that engagement piece to me is just as important, if not more important, than what actually goes on in a testing session.
K-12 educators are required to take courses in child development, and they talk about education theory. How do college professors learn to be teachers?
Well, first, we were professional students for a very long time. That is really, I think, where most professors get that information. Now, with the availability of all the different studies that have been run, I think we're seeing a much more educated group of professors who have really taught themselves what works and what doesn't work. And so what I find is the new faculty who come into the profession are very excited about trying new things, doing new things, because they've learned about teaching as a profession along with their area of scholarship.
What do you do to cultivate an environment in which students feel comfortable coming to you if they really aren't getting something, when they feel like maybe everybody around them is right on track?
So the first thing is to be incredibly patient. It's important, and it's just by luck of the draw, you happen to be talking to two chemistry professors. One thing to point out is the Academy has a lot of other disciplines involved. We're not all chemists. but chemistry in particular can be an intimidating subject, and the thing to remember is that it's hard for some people, and that even if we understand something, they may not. And so we just have to be extremely patient. And what I also love to do is praise good questions, even if they're the same ones that other students have, but realize and tell students that, you know, a lot of people have trouble with that. So let's talk about it some more. And it's really just about letting them feel safe to ask questions and not feel like there's an intimidating situation occurring around them. Because once you do that, they shut up. And if they ever feel as though you're becoming impatient or frustrated, you're not going to get another question out of that student, and that's absolutely the worst thing that you can possibly do.
I think availability is really important as well, making sure that students are aware that you're available for them. In fact, I like to create a scenario for students in my classes in which they assume that I just arise from the stage, give them a lecture, and then disappear and have nothing else to do in my life. They don't need to know about my research group. They don't need to know about committee meetings. They need to know that I'm there for them. And students are really sharp. They can sit. You can remember being a student. You know which faculty members are available, engaged, thinking about you, whether it's a large enrollment course or a smaller course. And students pick up on that. So that welcoming nature, that recognition of safe pathways and clearly communicated pathways where students can have contact with you and with class content in multiple ways allows, I think, most students to reach their potential.
Let me ask you about this. Some people look at those large survey classes that are taught in those, you know, theater-like or even stadium-like classrooms, and they say, well, we could take this lecture and put it online, and it can be just as effective. What is your sense of that, and what is maybe lost if you can't sort of read the room, even if you give the best lecture of your career?
My view on that is it's the difference between theater and cinema. There's something about a live performance. There's a spontaneity to it. There's an ability to respond based on what you see. This past semester, I taught two sections of General Chemistry 2. Both classes had over 200 students in it. And I feel a connection to the vast majority of those students, even in a large lecture hall. And I think many of them feel a connection to me, at least I hope they do. And you don't get that if there's a recorded lecture, if there's a component where students review it later. I think that live presentation allows students to see the emotion, the passion, the ability to ad-lib and respond based on how the course is going is really important, at least to me as the instructor, and I think students pick up on that as well.
Yeah, I think one of the themes in the Little Orange Book is how personal teaching really can be, and that just doesn't come across generally on a screen. There are very effective strategies for online learning, but it's not the same as being there and experiencing an emotional connection with a human being in front of the class doing everything they can to try to convey important information. One of the things I love to do is I have all my lectures recorded, and that seems to be almost the best of both worlds because the students still come, and I, at the end of the year, I always do surveys and ask my students questions like, do you see value in coming to lecture? And it was an overwhelming yes. But they also watch the lecture over and over again. So the idea of being able to see it multiple times is very beneficial. But the idea of being there and having a personal live connection is also something that students really do value. And so I think that when we think about technology, again, it's kind of a false choice to think it's either or. I think technology can enhance what we do, and we just have to learn how to use it in powerful ways. But that at the end of the day, human learns from humans.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting way in which the educational experts pitch modern teaching. There's a general trend that's been going on for some time that an instructor should really be what's called a guide on the side, and that it's almost viewed in a derogatory way if an instructor is a sage on the stage. So the idea being, are you facilitating an environment where students are learning by doing? That absolutely is a great thing to do. That's more the guide on the side. The sage on the stage, though, should not be viewed in a negative way. Every single person I've met, if they're asked to think back on singular aspects of their academic background, going back to K through 12, whether it's the university, graduate school, will point to singular people. They'll point to people that they came in contact with that were particularly impactful. And so people matter. And a sage on the stage can be one of the best ways to draw students into material. Again, get them interested and you'll become great at something. You're great at everything you're great at because you're interested in it. So really the role of the teacher is to get you interested.
What does it take to maintain enthusiasm for material that you may have been teaching for 20 years?
I teach the coolest stuff on the planet, so it's real easy for me. Yeah. So it's pretty easy to argue that what I talk about with my class is really what we consider modern life and the kind of things we do. And I've always been fascinated, will always be fascinated by what the human mind can and create, and the new materials, the new products, the new things that we can do, all because we can make and break bonds. And that's really what defines our modern existence. So for me, it's real easy.
Yeah, and I would say that I think teaching involves, especially in a formal classroom, a story. There's a journey students go on. It's not a bunch of facts that students have to memorize and report back on an exam. And that story may be the same in every general chemistry or organic chemistry class I teach, but the way I present it each semester varies. Some of that's done for my benefit, but the content is still there. It's the same content. But the way the story plays out for me and then for the students represents a unique aspect to that particular semester. So it's really not difficult at all. If I think I click through a bunch of PowerPoint slides every semester without giving a lot of thought to the story, the beginning, middle, and end that is represented in a single class and throughout the entire semester, then I think it can be quite dry, and students will pick up on that. They'll know. They'll know if you're engaged or not.
Mm-hmm. I found that students are surprised when I tell them that I haven't taught the same class ever twice. And so they're looking at old exams or old materials and saying, hey, this is different. And that's a surprise to them. But of course, it's different. Teaching courses really does feel like a journey because you start having to define words. And by the time you're done, they're experiencing the field. They're living whatever that discipline is. And I don't know if there's a more exciting vocation than being able to see that happen year after year with your students.
It's the most noble thing we do, not just in a formal classroom, because everyone's a teacher. The most noble thing we do is, I think, take time to raise someone else up. And fundamentally, that's what teachers do. They invest their efforts, their energy to raise someone up. And by raising someone up, you're empowering them. You're giving them information. You're allowing their mind to start think about things differently. It's wonderful to have a profession that allows me to impact students that way.
One of the chapters in the Little Orange Book talks about not talking down to students but raising them up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really one of the hallmarks of teachers who become really good at what they do is they see it that way. They're not convincing people they know things and therefore they're very smart. What they're trying to do is empower students to appreciate their discipline in the ways that they know will empower them to do exactly what they want to do.
What is the purpose of a college education?
So the purpose of a college education is to allow a person to become a successful member of society. And that has so many aspects to it, one of which is a job. But the other is to be able to process the complicated world around us and understand how all the different parts fit together. And so one of the things that I think we need to keep in mind at all times is that there really are two components to a college education that are critical for a successful outcome. Number one is depth. Students have to be an expert in something that is going to be very important to them, but they also have to have breadth because they have to be able to put that in perspective. And I think that right now we hear too often that there's a rush for the depth at the expense of breadth, and that's wrong. And so I think that we really need to make sure that students who are interested in STEM get a very broad humanities background so they understand how the world really does fit together. And by the same token, students with focusing on humanities also need to understand the technological world around them. And so I think that it's really important when students go off to college to realize it's not just about that first paycheck. It's about their life. What are they going to become? And who are they going to become? And how does that fit into the world around them? And that's not something you get with simply taking a set of requirements that gets you a certificate of some sort.
We're speaking this hour with Brent Iverson and John Seibert. Both are chemistry professors and members of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers. We'll be back to our conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with two of the 16 contributors to The Little Orange Book, Short Lessons in Excellent Teaching. It's a publication of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers. My guests this hour are John Seibert of UT Dallas and Brent Iverson of UT Austin. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. What do you think, John, is the purpose of a college education?
It's a great question, and I think it's a question that students and parents should ask as well. It's a burden to put that on students, 17, 18 years of age, for traditional students coming out of high school, to think that deeply. I think most students at some point in their college careers will have those kinds of thoughts. And it's really a key question, because the short answer is to give students skill sets so that they become experts, or at least accomplished in their disciplines, and they can be productive. I have a picture I took outside the tower at UT Austin, Brent's home campus, and it says the core purpose, so this would be for UT Austin, but it applies to all universities, the core purpose, and written in granite, to transform lives for the benefit of society. It's a generic expression, but if you give some thought to it, the university should be transformative. And it's not just about going to class. It's about what you do outside of the class as well. It's what you can take from the university, because there's so much the university is willing to give. But students have to be receptive to that idea as well. We need better voters. We need a more literate society, scientifically literate. We need better consumers. We need to hold marketers and politicians to certain requirements. We need to be cynical. We need to ask questions. And all of that should play out over the course of the university experience, beyond just what's learned in the classes.
How did this book come about?
The Academy of Distinguished Teachers wanted to make a difference. So we did not want this to be an honorific group where we get a plaque, we stick it on the wall, and we're done. We wanted to address a very important need. And that need, we felt, was educating new faculty members on their way in on how to be effective teachers. And it's one thing to say, why don't you go and listen to a bunch of lectures by more established or well-known faculty members in your department? It's another to say, here's a book with all the best tips in it. And by taking all of the different ideas from the faculty who span all the different disciplines at their own institutions, you ought to be able to find something in there that's for you. And so with the small amount of money that UT System gave us, we have these books printed. And this fall, every incoming faculty member is going to get a free copy of this book as part of their entry into the University of Texas system across the entire state.
What I'm pleased with is, while it sounds like the target audience would be new faculty members, the breadth of content in this book and the personal comments from folks who've made careers out of teaching others, I think makes it of great benefit to even students. If a student read this, they get a snapshot, maybe more than a snapshot, of what faculty members think who are responsible for creating learning environments. Parents who are teachers. As soon as you sign up to be a parent, you're a teacher. You get a view of how your interactions with others matter, and how you can maximize those interactions for the benefit of both.
What does it take when you have students who have newly arrived on a college campus to sort of allow them to latch back onto their own curiosity, if they've maybe spent a lot of years being told what they should be curious about and what they need to learn?
That happens at different points for different students, and it's something that we talk about a lot, even in academy meetings. How do we give students an opportunity to explore? How do we give students an opportunity to fail? It is so hyper-competitive at the high school level to try to get into college. You have this feeling like one mistake and you're somehow off the train and you can't get back on. And we need to create environments in our classes that prevent that, that allow them to look at new things and maybe say something that's not so appropriate, but then find out how to get their head around what this new idea is and really find that inner passion. One of the things that's interesting is to ask adults how many of them are actually doing today what they went to college to do. And you find out that's usually about 10 or 15% of people my age. And the interesting thing, when you compare that to our students, they're positive they know what they want to do until they take that first set of classes. So what I find is that second semester freshman is the one who's really interested in exploring and figuring out if they're really in the right place or not. And you have to create an environment where it's safe enough for them that they don't feel like exploring is a diversion, because it's not.
I'm going to use a different word than exploring: play.
Yeah.
play belongs in a learning environment, whether it's a formal classroom or you're learning how to play a sport in a park by yourself or with family or friends. Play is critical, and a savvy instructor thinks about that. How do I create discussions, coursework, in-class assignments, for example, that may not count very much for a grade or may not count at all for a grade, but allow students to play with material and not look at it with a progression to get an answer, but just get a chance to look at something from the left-hand side, the right-hand side, top and bottom, with no real goal other than to become immersed in it. And they're better for it in the process. And that takes a lot of effort for freshmen because they're typically not taught in environments like that in K through 12 where the focus is on getting answers. And we care about answers too. But I'm far more interested in getting students up to speed with respect to the skill sets needed to develop their own answers. And if they make some mistakes along the way, it's okay. They will get more answers right than not. But if the focus becomes on the answer from the instructor side, the focus will be on the answer from the student side. And you can compromise learning that way too, even for students that perform well on exams.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to, I think it's Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes, sir. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I've got a comment and a question for our two eminent chemistry professors here. My sister has a PhD in organic chemistry from Purdue, and I, her brother, only have a mere BS in engineering, but that doesn't mean we can't talk once in a while. We got on the subject the other day of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, 1927. Talked about relativity, 1905 by Einstein, quantum theory in the 1920s. My sister directed the entire class to how that connects to existentialism in Camus, Sartre, in literature. And with 20 million people dead after World War I, how this affected society at large. And I was impressed by how my sister took something started very scientific, and she worked it into something that's relevant for society and culture. And I'll take my answer off the air, but my question for you two gentlemen is, do you do the same thing?
Doug, that's a great point, and it speaks to the difference between knowledge and information. So information would be a set of topics. You mentioned a whole bunch of scientific topics there, from quantum mechanics, Heisenberg uncertainty principle, et cetera. Each of those can be taught, read from in a textbook, tested on, and students can even master the content so that they look proficient on an exam. But I can make an argument that what they're really doing is gathering information. They don't really have the knowledge. And what your sister sounds like she did is she drew connections. And what knowledge is the connections between pieces of information. It's the story. And the story involves relevance. It involves linking how one topic connects to another. It also involves an individual being able to connect the information they're processing with their background knowledge from all their prior years of being on this planet. That's when you get a learned individual that sees the connections between separate pieces of information.
Yeah, I can't agree more. One of the things that's really exciting is when a student will come up to me and say, well, we talked about a particular type of reaction, and they make a connection to that in their biochemistry class, and then they realize how that influences what goes on in modern medicine. And you realize that that's what we're all about. Courses are not compact units that are meant to be looked at individually. You've got to make those connections. And getting students to do that is exactly the key. And that's what a college education really needs to be all about. And that's why, although it's really important to focus on depth in a discipline, it's also very important when students navigate a university not to take the easiest core classes they can get their hands on, but look for the ones that are really going to challenge them and expand their horizons so they can make these incredible connections.
I took a geology course in college, and I think I took it so I didn't have to get up before 9 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It wasn't like I had a particular passion. Made a C in the course, but the professor was so interesting and exciting. I don't remember a lot of the exact details of what I learned, and this probably breaks your hearts as chemistry professors, but this geology class, it connected me to my environment in a way that has never gone away 25 years later. Like, I still think about, you know, before it just seemed like the built environment was where we existed and geology was out in nature. And I wonder what you do with the fact that some of your students who don't go on to, you know, more and more science classes, this is it for them, and they won't necessarily remember the facts that you communicate, but maybe there's something they take away about your enthusiasm or your philosophy of learning?
Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about what students are going to be recalling 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, and beyond for my course. And if you frame the entire course around that, and one of the sections in the book talks about this, think about the end before you think about the beginning. It allows you to look at things in a new way. And so in my world, I like students to understand how molecules and their behavior actually predicts things they do understand. How do medicines work? Why is it that water is a liquid and methane is a gas? Those things are going to stay with the student because they're going to look at things in a new way and say, why did that freeze? What is that? And those are exactly the kind of connections you want to make with real life. And I think a successful teacher will be thinking all along, what are they really going to remember? And it's not facts. What are those main lessons they're going to learn? And I will talk to students about this and say, you're not going to remember all the different reactions in a synthesis that you create, but you're going to remember that you created a synthetic pathway that was new to you but could make a target molecule you wanted to make. You'll remember that. I also think that if faculty members are honest about what students are going to take away from their course 10 years from when they leave, they'll emphasize different things. So, for example, the way you determine structure of molecules is through something called nuclear magnetic resonance, which is the same principle as what we use behind MRI imaging. I know that that's going to be the most transferable skill that comes out of my class, is understanding what goes on when you go in that big ring and you get that strange noise and they say, don't move, and the next thing you know, there's a picture inside your body. Well, all my students understand exactly how that works now, because I know 10 years from now, they're going to need that. I would like to think that they're going to understand a Claisen reaction and an Aldol reaction for those 10 years. Unless they go into chemistry, probably not. But by focusing on that end game, it allows you to spend, and I'll spend an entire week explaining nuclear magnetic resonance and connecting that to MRI. And students who come talk to me 10 years later have verified, yeah, that's what they remember. And they also do remember that excitement and that passion. And I think to sum all of this up in my mind, the information we teach in the technical disciplines, especially in the technical disciplines, does become obsolete. But the inspiration that you can provide to a student will last a lifetime. And that's really the end game. That's the 10, 20-year horizon.
I'll reiterate what I said earlier. Oftentimes, new instructors miss this part of having the chance to interact with young people or people of any age, and that is that they're ambassadors for their field. That's a significant role, maybe more significant than specific content in terms of a long-term legacy. Parents as well, you represent information when you interact with your kids. And that representation, you hope, is if it's you're an expert in the field, is one that's full of passion, it has information, it gives students a chance to play with content. But ultimately, if you can get the students to appreciate content, you mentioned a geology class. Perhaps when you're driving through northwestern New Mexico, you see the Echo Amphitheater and you look at the rock structure, and maybe it just makes you think back a little bit, but this is really beautiful. This is cool. And that appreciation is important. That links back to a sage on the stage who drew you into content. It's really important to have those contexts. Just very briefly, when I was a kid, this is going to date me, there was not 1,000 TV stations. There was ABC, CBS, NBC, UHF stations.
And PBS.
Right. Of course, absolutely. And the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau would come on seasonally. And it was extraordinarily formative for me. I didn't realize it until I was self-reflective and writing some essays in the Little Orange Book. Why was that informative? There was so much teaching going on, and as a student watching the television, I was unaware of how much teaching. There was speculation. There was information. I was brought into a world I knew nothing about and found it fascinating. So what is that legacy? I'm fascinated by marine science. I love aquariums. You put me near the water. I want to go under the water. It almost became my career. So that's an example. That's not in a classroom. But it shows if there's interest, if there's a person who is responsible for demonstrating the importance and the relevance of a particular topic, their legacy can be extraordinary, lifetime to the individuals that they come in contact with. Sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jeff on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. And I believe it's Brent and John.
That's right.
Okay. I want to relate. You were talking about the professors being on stage and, you know, connecting with the student. When I was in a first-year college calculus course, the class was quite large. And so the first day, the instructor looked at the first row and said, I want you, you, and you to go to the back and let some people that are low-sighted come to the front. Well, one of the guys sat there and said, no, I'm not going back there. I got here early to get a seat up front. Well, naturally, there was a huge hush in the room, and the instructor looked at the graduate assistant and said, Mr. So-and-so, drop that man from the roll. And just by sheer luck, another student said, no, I'll go to the back and let somebody have my seat. I don't think somebody should be thrown out of class just for wanting to be able to see the board good. So that's a perfect example of how fast things can go downhill if a professor, you know, loses the connection totally. And so for the rest of the year, that calculus class had huge dropout rates, and, you know, it just didn't go good at all.
Thanks so much for your call. It's an interesting perspective on some of what we've been talking about.
Well, you know, one of the things I learned very early on was something that, for lack of a better term, I refer to as a mirror effect. And what that means is that a student's reaction in general in a class to a topic is pretty much a mirror of how they perceive the professor and their interaction with the topic. So if they perceive that a professor is not really interested in what they're saying and not really engaged in the class, the students won't be either. If the professor is really excited about what they're doing, the students will be. This is a very, very powerful idea, because what it means is, if you're an instructor, small class, large class, doesn't matter, and you don't like the atmosphere in the class, all you have to do to try to fix that is look in the mirror and say, okay, how are my students perceiving me? And how can I change that so that it's exactly the way I want them to be interacting with the discipline?
Can I interject something here? I don't want to take us off topic, but Brent's comments there apply to people,
yeah,
not professors and students, of people. How you interact with others, especially if you have some content knowledge, impacts their view of that content. I mean, can you think of a more significant lesson to learn if you're a parent than the way you present and share information with your children? They're biased by your own experiences. And if you can somehow keep an open mind, that'll allow them to naturally migrate and develop in areas that become their own interests.
We're speaking this hour with John Seibert of UT Dallas and Brent Iverson of UT Austin, both members of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers, which has just published the Little Orange Book, Short Lessons in Excellent Teaching. It has 16 authors who contributed short essays to the book. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth, with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Brent Iverson of UT Austin and John Seibert of UT Dallas. Both are professors of chemistry, and both are members of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers, which has just published the 16-author book called The Little Orange Book, Short Lessons in Excellent Teaching. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So is there like an Academy of Distinguished Teaching in every state that has a university system in the country?
To the best of our knowledge, we're the first system-wide Academy of Distinguished Teachers. Different campuses in the state have their own academies, but we believe this is the only academy that spans all the different institutions in a statewide system.
How is it possible that no one recognized that this could be useful before now?
It's a difficult question to answer. I can tell you that now that I'm part of this academy, the time I spend with them is extraordinarily helpful and just plain out fun for me. There is so much I need to learn and want to learn about my profession, about students, about others. And sometimes I wish that we would just record our meetings. I think there's what you'll find is a whole bunch of folks with different backgrounds, different areas of expertise. And you'll see the same kinds of things that play out in this book, lessons that we want to share with others, on display in terms of how we interact with each other. It's fun to be around people who are interested in things. It doesn't matter. Doesn't mean they have to be interested in the same things I am. People who are interested in the world are interesting. Those are the folks you want to have a cup of coffee with, that you want to have a lunch with.
Yeah, and I think it provides an incredible conduit of information across the entire state. There's about 200,000 students at our respective campuses around the state of Texas, and now we have a way to talk about what's working on different campuses and share that information in a way that's immediately practical. And I didn't really miss it before we had academy meetings, but now I understand how important this has been. I am such a better teacher now because of the people that I've met and the conversations I've had that never could have happened without the academy.
I'm guessing, based on your careers, that both of you, were stellar students all along, went straight through school. I've often thought, I was a good student, but I've often thought, boy, I would be a much better student today. And I wouldn't want to wait all those years to, have an undergraduate education, but is there a value to the idea of a gap year that maybe we should think more about in the United States, like give kids a year or two of work experience, or is the fear that maybe we would lose them and they would find other things to do besides pursue an education?
I'm not a huge fan of the gap year. I certainly can understand arguments for it. I think, as I said earlier, people are naturally curious. If you can create that environment straight out of high school where students understand what the expectations are and you hold standards high and you draw them in and give them chances to play with content, that they're going to progress beautifully and they don't need a year to, quote unquote, mature. I'm not sure they necessarily are going to come a year later with better study skills. And you also have to be careful about the professors always being, in their backgrounds, great students. Most of the faculty members have not done well in all of their courses and have had their own slip-ups because we were students and still are students in many ways. And I think those experiences actually are also formative. They help you understand that mastering content, trying to be able to be successful in a course requires a commitment from the student side as well. I had to learn that. Absolutely. I had to learn that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, true confession, I never got an A in organic chemistry when I was an undergraduate. but at the very end of the course, it was an individual, a person, that got me very excited about the field. And when I finally understood what was really happening, it's ignited a lifelong passion. So I've often felt that really helped me because I absolutely understand organic chemistry from a struggling student's point of view. And it helps you appreciate what students are really going after. One of the pieces in the book that I think is really important to remember is it's titled, It's Not Their Whole Life. Because, in fact, it may be your life's work and passion. It's just another class to some students. And you have to put that into your entire impression of what you're going to present in that class and realize that you've got to attract that student who really might be distracted for a whole lot of really good reasons, but you have to be realistic about how much time they're going to spend. And we see that young faculty members often forget this point, that it is just one of four or five classes students are taking, and it's important to make sure that you're realistic about that approach as you talk to students and don't wonder why they don't spend 10 hours a day on your topic and only your topic.
Yeah. True confessions, I hated general chemistry, freshman chemistry when I took it. Absolutely despised it. It was the least engaging course I think I took, and I'm a chemistry professor. And so that speaks to the significance of the way a course is structured and the person up at the front of the lecture hall in terms of their impact.
What brought you back after a bad freshman year experience in chemistry?
People bring you back. Yeah. I was exposed to chemistry in a different way. And ultimately, when I went to graduate school, I met Professor John Sessler, one of Brent's colleagues at UT Austin. And there was a real joy of learning around him. And that joy of learning is so important to cultivate that it's okay. It sounds almost like we should all hold hands and sing around a campfire and let's learn together. That's a bit naive. But there truly is, in a classic, engaging learning environment, a joy of time spent with material. And the right person can draw that out regardless of content. And professors are uniquely equipped to have that opportunity.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Alicia's on the line in Dallas. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Chris. Sure. I am very interested in the topic that you're covering today. Hello, professors.
Hello.
Hey. I'm on faculty at a local university and can relate to so much of what you're saying. And the question that I have for you all is a little bit of a segue, but wonder what you think about this newish idea that we are moving more towards a customer-centered model wherein our students and their families are consumers of sort of the education and expertise that we have to offer. It's, I think, in contrast to the more traditional ivory tower model that we've experienced.
Boy, that's a big question. We could probably bump the next guest and spend the next hour talking about that.
Very easily.
That's a great question, and these are important ideas. Due to the cost of public education, higher at universities and colleges across the country, both public and private, parents, legislators, people have a real interest and a deserved interest in wanting to know what's going on in the learning environment. I think one has to be careful about acting too much on that interest and allowing experts to do their jobs. But the student as a consumer, that's a hot button issue. If you're paying a lot of money, there should be something you get from that, and that leads intimately to assessment. And so that then leads to I got 25 questions out of 30 right. Therefore, it was time and money well spent. I think that's not the appropriate way, at least in a singular way, to assess whether an education experience is valuable or not. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Brent?
So I've had 3 kids go through the university systems here in Texas. 4th is about to start. So I've seen this from various points of view. And the bottom line is that we do what we do because we are the experts. But at the same time, the world is changing around us. And I don't see it so much as a consumer-centered model as I do. We need to make sure that what we're doing is adapting to what's happening with the students. The students who are starting now are very different than the students who just graduated. And we need to accommodate that. And we need to understand the world they're going to live in when they leave the university. And we need to focus our attention on what's going to make it best for them to be truly successful. John said it before, and I don't want to just rely on a cliche, but it's something that has transformed our university, is this idea that our core purpose is to transform lives for the betterment of society. With that as a goal, we understand this from various points of view, and thinking about students as consumers is fine because their parents are paying a lot of money for them, or they may be paying a lot of money for them to go to a university. But at the same time, we're the ones who have to take into account what's happening outside and adapt our educational practices so that our students are best prepared to be successful when they leave.
The other part about the student as a consumer model that one has to be careful of is it leads down a path, if you're not attentive, it leads down a path where the goal of the instructor and the course would be to open up your head. Imagine just physically opening up your head, cram as much information in as possible, then sew up your head really fast and give an exam immediately before anything falls out. And so, you know, how much knowledge is being gained in that scenario and how much would be based on the assessment with respect to the answer to that question? And there's a disconnect there. When you teach freshmen in particular, that first semester is a challenge for freshmen, for many of them. It's a transition to a university life. There's a maturation. There's a social aspect. There's certainly an academic aspect, and you want to get off to a fast start. My concern oftentimes is when a student comes to UT Dallas, and we have just phenomenal students. Brent and I can go back and forth on who has better students, UT Dallas, UT Austin, all win. But anyway, we won't have that debate. But if a student gets a 50 on an exam for their first test their freshman year, I don't want the response from the student to be, oh, no, I'm not competitive. Oh, no, I can't be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever I want to be. I want the response to be that I don't lose confidence, but the way I prepared for this exam was not the best way to prepare. I now have to go to the professor, become more receptive to other ways to study. I need to become a better student. Many students don't respond that way, and they put themselves down a pathway that isn't one that they're going to be successful. A poor grade in a class, especially early on, it sometimes can be the best thing for a student because it says that what you're doing isn't good enough, and you're better than that. You're better than that, and we can tap into that to get you to maximize your potential. Standards are really important, but you have to show pathways so students can be successful. So student as a consumer has a lot of slippery slopes associated with it.
It does, but you bring up an issue that I wanted to get to anyway, and that is one of the things that we have to recognize is that often students don't know how to learn our material. And so one of the things that I think instructors should spend a lot of time thinking about is what do you need to teach students to inform them how they're going to learn your set of material? How do you provide them with the tools that they don't come equipped with because they've never seen your discipline before? So I think that's a really important aspect of this, that it doesn't really focus on whether you think about a student as a consumer or not, but it is important to realize that they don't have experience with your topic. And just giving information, opening up the head, dumping it in is not the right way to go. It's what are those pathways that have been successful? So one of the things I love to do is give surveys at the end of classes and ask the students what they did. So what did you do to prepare for this exam? I then share that information with students the next semester and say, here's what the successful students were doing to prepare. And then I try to put together materials that will facilitate that process. And I've watched the amount of learning in the class skyrocket as soon as I started doing that. So give them the tools that they need, but then learn from them about what was making them successful collectively. Tell that to the next group, and they're all learning from each other. It's been really interesting to watch.
Do you feel like you're competing with the technology they have on their desktops or in their palms?
Competing in terms of getting their attention?
For attention, yeah. Because, of course, they can be taking notes, and, of course, they can be checking email or going online. Maybe not in your classes,
well,
but some of your
colleagues. Well, an effective instructor will not be competing. Mm-hmm. An ineffective instructor might be. It's something to be thinking about, and that's part of this idea of adapting to what's going on out there. I would turn that question around and say, students are so well connected to each other. How can you exploit that in a positive way? How can you let them share information about your course in a positive way? And if you spend time thinking about how they're going to use social media to enhance what's going on in your own class, you realize that this is very powerful indeed. And so I don't really worry about them being distractive. I look at it and say, what can I do that can really take advantage of what they're doing?
Agreed. And also, I think the current generation of students, kind of the demographic of 15 to 35, they're great at multitasking. I like one window open on a computer when I work. My daughter might have five windows open at the same time.
You are a dinosaur, John. You are a dinosaur.
I appreciate that. Anyway, so the idea is what is the assessment telling you? You know, if you're able to be successful based on a study model that is working for you, why should I come in and force you to prepare differently? But if you're not, you've got to be willing to recognize that a healthy university is going to make you a better student. You're going to have to change. You're going to have to change. And for people who are looking at students as consumers, then a short-term assessment becomes the end-all, be-all of whether that student is successful or not. And sometimes that short-term assessment is purely communication, that what you're doing isn't good enough. And a long-term assessment of that student may go back to that singular moment where you would say this was a failure, but it might have been the best thing that could have ever happened to that student.
How do you know it's working?
The best way I know it's working is when I get unanticipated emails from former students. Hmm. So one of the things I'm a big believer in is fitness. So one of the things that students, and believe it or not, my organic chemistry class, they hear, and any of my former students out there are going to say, oh, here he goes, is that people are not truly successful unless they're healthy. And that a college student experience should be more than just content. And so I do a lot of things to get students interested in fitness, and my class runs a race. It runs a 5K or a 10K every year. And it really makes that point. And I have had student after student after student tell me that that was the thing that changed their trajectory and their health, because somebody was willing to quit talking about organic chemistry for 5 minutes at the end of a lecture and say, this is really important. You need to do this. When you get that kind of feedback, you know that you've been successful.
Brent Iverson is professor of chemistry at UT Austin and outgoing president of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers. John Seibert is associate professor of chemistry at UT Dallas and president of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers, which has published The Little Orange Book, Short Lessons in Excellent Teaching. It's been wonderful to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.